It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and our guest says waffle irons are for more than just waffles, and he's got the recipes to prove it.
First, the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court heard arguments in Wisconsin's voter ID case today. After a nearly three-year legal battle, a panel of three Republican-appointed judges will now decide if the Wisconsin law requiring voters to show photo ID at the polls should be reactivated in time for the elections this November.
Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson was in Chicago to hear the arguments, joins us now for an update. Sean, it's good to have you back.
Good to be back.
So what was the tone like in court today?
The tone was, you know, having seen a few of these arguments before federal court recently, there have been arguments where the lawyer will get up there to make his or her case, and about a minute in, the judges will cut them off. You didn't see that when the Wisconsin Department of Justice got up there to make their case about why voter ID should be reinstated in Wisconsin. The judges heard them out, and really their tougher questions were directed at the plaintiffs for the ACLU and other groups representing voters who sued successfully to overturn voter ID at the district court level. The judges want to know really the basis of that and, you know, seem to be trying to get at whether they could, see making a similar ruling at the appeals court level. But they seem to have some serious issues with it.
What do we know about the judges hearing the case?
You had three-judge panel, Judge Easterbrook, Judge Sykes, Judge Tinder. They're all appointed by Republican presidents. Judge Sykes, Diane Sykes, a former Wisconsin Supreme Court justice, kind of a conservative darling in Wisconsin prior to her ascent to the federal appeals bench. Judge Easterbrook's actually hearing another high-profile Wisconsin case, heard it this week, an offshoot of one of our John Doe investigations here in Wisconsin. But Easterbrook's somebody who's pretty widely respected, I think, in the federal court system. And Easterbrook and Sykes really dominated discussion today. Sykes, in particular, signaled where she was viewing this from. And, you know, she said a few things. She said the eve of the election is upon us, as she was asking, you know, what are we going to do here? She also repeatedly referenced the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in another voter ID case and said, look, the Supreme Court has established that states have a real interest, a viable interest in regulating, in passing laws to prevent election fraud. And she also said, going through my notes here, those were a couple of the points that she made, you know, repeatedly. The other thing she said was that the Wisconsin Supreme Court had basically taken care of the cost issue when it comes to voter ID. Wisconsin Supreme Court issued a ruling in another lawsuit recently where Justice Patience Rogensack upheld voter ID, but at the same time, kind of in a footnote, told the Wisconsin DMV, look, you can't charge for IDs. You can't require documents that come at a cost to get those voter IDs. You're not a party to this lawsuit, but look, figure this out. And so this week, just a couple days ago, the DMV came out and said, we have a system now to deal with that. The Wisconsin Department of Justice brought that up in court today, and Diane Sykes said from the bench, the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision took care of the cost issue.
All right, so that's off the table in terms of the undue burden factor, then.
In her eyes, the ACLU attorneys bringing this suit obviously have a different take. You did not hear Judge Easterbrook or Judge Tinder make such strong assertions from the bench, so you don't know where they're coming from on this. You did hear Judge Easterbrook, though, question, you know, why we should let a district judge, Judge Edelman, who overturned voter ID at the district level, why let him make an assertion that there is no state interest or that in regulating voter fraud when the U.S. Supreme Court has said otherwise?
And one of the questions on the table is, should the voter ID law be upheld, could it be implemented? Could it be up in action by the November elections? And I understand the judges put that out there, that question on the table.
Yeah, I mean, I would say up until today's hearing, at least I've been operating under the assumption that voter ID would not be in effect for this November's elections. You know, the thought being that the legal process moved slow until recently. It was tied up not only in federal court, but in state court. After today's hearing, I'm not so sure. I mean, the lawyer for the Wisconsin Department of Justice said, why don't you just issue a stay today, take care of this, put it back on the books. You didn't hear any of the judges say, like, you're crazy or we're not going to move that fast. And Judge Sykes said, you know, that the eve of the election is upon us. And I actually, the reaction from the ACLU attorneys after the hearing, I thought was sort of telling. They very forcefully said, no court has ever reinstated a law like this close to an election. And to do that would be just catastrophic. It'd be an invitation for disaster. They seem to be taking that threat very seriously.
So just based on what you're saying, it looks like that's something that could happen.
It definitely looks like something that could happen. I guess the caution you have to throw to this is that judges often play devil's advocate when they're in arguments. They want to kind of try to find weak spots in the argument. And so it's possible that's what they were doing here. I don't think that's what Justice Sykes was doing, though. I think we know where she stands. The question is whether one of the other judges is going to stand with her in this.
Is this decision likely to impact this question elsewhere in the country?
Yes, because they brought kind of a novel argument in Wisconsin. I mean, voter ID laws have been challenged elsewhere. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on them elsewhere. The challenge they brought in Wisconsin was based on Section 2 of the Voter Rights Act. Normally, that's applied to redistricting cases. The attorneys in this case said it fit in Wisconsin because just statistically, they said a voter ID law requiring a photo ID to vote is more apt to deter minority voters from casting a ballot. And so they brought this Section 2 challenge. And, you know, if they were to prevail here, this they did at the district level, if they were to prevail in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, I think you'd definitely see that challenge repeated elsewhere in the country. You know, I don't know that that's going to happen. I mean, a lot of the questions, which were more technical in nature from Judge Easterbrook, seem to be getting at, how do we measure this? You know, is there a percentage of voter turnout that makes it a violation of Section 2 or a percentage of people who have the IDs? How do we make this ruling that can be replicated in other courtrooms?
Now, recently we saw the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal handing down a decision on Wisconsin's gay marriage ban with incredible speed. Do you have a sense of the pacing on this one?
No. I mean, I guess I wouldn't be surprised if it happened fast. That decision was handed down much faster than usual for the federal court system. I think if they were to move quickly, it would be to stay the Judge Edelman's ruling, and they could issue their own decision later. But really, the clock is ticking. We're pretty close. We're less than 2 months from the election. So to get this new law up and working that quickly, as the ACLU attorneys said, you know, it's a tall order. It's something Wisconsin hasn't had for an election like this, of this level of turnout in its history. So, yeah, the clock is ticking.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter, talking about the arguments in Wisconsin's voter ID case heard at the Seventh Circuit Court. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday, and today we're having breakfast for dinner and lunch and everything in between. Our guest is a waffle-making genius, and there's almost nothing he hasn't tried to waffle.
Daniel Shumsky joins us now. He's the creator of the waffleizer.com website and the author of the book Will It Waffle? 53 Unexpected Recipes to Make in a Waffle Iron. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So you've made it pretty much your mission in life to figure out every possible application for the waffle iron. So I guess my question for you is why? What do you like so much about waffling your food?
Well, here's the reason it came about, which is that I do love my waffle iron, and it is sort of my mission to make it more useful because I don't love this idea that there are appliances that are only good for one thing and just taking up counter space the rest of the time.
And you give a little waffle history before we get into the recipes, including the history of the waffle frolic. Do you have a favorite moment in waffle history?
You know, what was really interesting to me when I was researching the book was finding out that waffles and waffle irons sort of go back to the founding of our country. So when Thomas Jefferson came back from France in 1789, one of the things that he is said to have brought back was a waffle iron.
And the one that really got me was that the Nike shoe company owes its origins to waffles.
Yeah, absolutely. Apparently the sole of the shoe initially was put into a waffle iron, and so that it had that sort of grid pattern on the bottom.
And how far back, you mentioned the dawn of American history, do waffles go back even further?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the reasons that we have these sort of pressed discs of dough is because in the medieval times that you can trace them back to communion wafers.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, as far as the modern-day waffle, and we'll say we want to buy in and start cooking our own waffles and other things, what do we need?
Well, here's what I tell people, which is that I get the question a lot, what's the best waffle iron to get? And I tell people, you know, there's a really good chance that you already have a waffle iron collecting dust in your cabinet or on top of the refrigerator, or maybe a relative of yours has one that they don't use. And that's really the number one indispensable piece of equipment is a waffle iron. And beyond that, there are a handful of tools, like maybe a nonstick, a silicone spatula, and some nonstick spray, but that's about it.
How many waffle irons do you have?
I don't know if I should admit this, but I have 6 waffle irons.
Are they all different?
Yeah, they're all different. One of the things that was really important to me when I was doing the recipes for this book was making sure that, you know, when I was asking the question, will it waffle, I wanted to make sure that the answer was consistent across the board so that when people use the recipes in the book, no matter what kind of waffle iron they had, it would work. So I was testing it in a bunch of different waffle irons.
Now, to be clear, when you ask the question, will it waffle, we're not just talking about making up batter and making waffles. That's a small part of your book. You are on a mission to find out what you can and cannot waffle in this world.
That's right. That is exactly right. So I know that waffle batter will waffle, right? But the question in writing the book was, well, look, that's great. I love waffles. But what else can we make in the waffle iron? And so we're talking about a whole range of foods from breakfast, lunch, dinner, dessert, talking about things like cookies and quesadillas and all sorts of things.
Well, you've got some fans out there. We heard from a listener named Nick in Milwaukee already who says, waffled hash browns and waffled cookies spin me super happy, but I'm wondering if you have conquered waffled lasagna. If so, please share the recipe. Now, I don't think that one is in your book. At least I didn't see it. But can we get close to something similar to waffled lasagna?
Maybe. I have to put in a little plug for the waffled hash browns because those are amazing. You don't even have to flip them and both sides get crispy from the two-sided heat of the waffle iron. It's like, I don't know why anybody makes hash browns any other way.
That is usually the challenge with hash browns is that you have one layer that has some brown and the rest of it is just kind of white and mushy.
Yeah, or you have to sit there and futz with it to get it to brown in all the right places, right? But the waffle iron takes care of all of that for you and it comes out with this fantastic grid pattern on it. It's one of my favorite recipes in the book.
Sir, you're dodging the question.
No, what,
how close can we get to lasagna on the waffle iron?
So what I will tell you about waffle lasagna is I haven't tried it yet.
Huh.
I do know that in the book has a recipe for spaghetti with waffled meatballs.
Hmm.
So I wouldn't say that the pasta area is unexplored, but the lasagna has not yet, I haven't tackled that one yet.
Does that get a little crispy, the spaghetti and meatballs on the waffle iron?
Well, you make the pasta as you normally would, and then you make the meatballs in the waffle iron, and they end up with these divots, these nooks and crannies that sort of collect the sauce.
Wow, that does sound good. Well, you do get a little close to the lasagna in a recipe that I think is genius, waffled mac and cheese.
Yes. I love the waffled mac and cheese because this is, again, where that two-sided heat of the waffle iron really pays off. You get the nice, crunchy exterior and then the melty, gooey, cheesy inside.
And breadcrumbs turned out to be the secret.
Yeah, what I found was that if you waffled the mac and cheese without sort of an insulating layer of breadcrumbs, it kind of fell apart. So that little bit of breadcrumb not only adds a bit of crunch, but it kind of protects the mac and cheese inside.
Well, we're sharing one of your egg recipes on our Facebook page, Central Time Facebook page. It's eggs migas? Migas?
Yes. Migas, yeah.
Migas. So tell us about that one.
So what I love, there are a few recipes in the book that use eggs in the waffle iron, which is maybe not what you would normally think to cook in the waffle iron. This one is a little bit of a Latin touch. It's sort of a scrambled eggs with a little bit of a Latin flavor to it. And you mix up some eggs with some tortilla and some tomato and onion, and you put it all in the waffle iron and close the waffle iron. And when you open it up a few minutes later, you've got this, essentially it's a scrambled egg waffle is maybe the best way to describe it.
And it looks really delicious. So that's a breakfasty one. That's not pushing the boundaries too far, but it's definitely taking a new spin on it. And the other recipe that we're sharing is a recipe for red velvet cake ice cream sandwiches.
Oh, yeah, man. I had to test that one a lot when I was writing the book.
Oh, poor you.
Yeah, poor me is right. The thing about that I love is that, you know, I think red velvet waffles are maybe not terribly surprising, but what I was really looking for with this one was to replicate that sort of cookie texture that you get when you're eating an ice cream sandwich. And so what you are looking at when you see this is these two beautiful sort of scarlet red waffles on either side, sandwiching some vanilla ice cream in the middle and then chocolate chips. You know, the ice cream is dunked in chocolate chips, so it's sort of studded with the chocolate chips on the outside.
I just keep asking myself as I read your book and hear you talk about these things, why am I not eating this right now?
We've been really hungry this morning getting ready for this interview, I have to confess.
Yeah. So another one in the dessert category, following about the red velvet, that I really like the sound of, the s'more waffle, the s'moreful, I think is how you build it.
Yeah, the s'moreful. That is a genius idea. I can't even take all the credit for that one. I had a friend who owned a chocolate shop, and when I came to her with an idea of making things in the waffle iron that weren't waffles, she said, we've got to try s'mores. And so, you know, I had no argument. I was happy to try it. And this is one of these, I can't even tell you how fun this is to do. You make graham cracker dough, and then you make that in the waffle iron, and then you sandwich chocolate and marshmallow between the two graham cracker dough pieces, and you put it all together in the waffle iron, and it just gets so delicious and melty and gooey. It's amazing.
So you've obviously experimented with tons of recipes and, you know, even more on your Waffleizer website. But what is your favorite thing to make? What is your go-to waffle recipe?
Oh, man. You're putting me on the spot here. I think I gravitate sometimes toward the things that are just quicker and easier to do in the waffle iron. So let's just take something. There's a few of the recipes, those sorts of recipes in the book. But let's take something like the waffle quesadillas, where when you're making a quesadilla, what you really want is heat from both sides, and you don't want it to, you know, take too long, right? And the waffle iron is the perfect machine to use for quesadillas.
Great. Well, we should probably put in a plug for something healthy. You got any good veggies that work really well on the waffle iron?
There are a ton of veggie recipes in the book. One of my favorites is the waffled zucchini parmesan fritters.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also a waffled portobello mushroom in there.
So what does that do? Let's take the mushroom. How does that serve us to cook that in a waffle iron?
Well, I think one of the things to always consider is that you've got two things going on here. You've got the two-sided heat of the waffle iron, so it makes it quicker than other things, other methods of cooking. And the other thing to consider, I think, is that, you know, we eat with our eyes first, and everything that comes out of the waffle iron ends up with this kind of fun grid pattern on it. And when something is just looks out of the ordinary, it looks a little fun, looks a little more different, it sets your expectations a little bit higher. It's kind of an adult way to play with your food.
And somebody, when I told them we were doing this show, was like, well, why not just use one of those home electric grills? Why does it have to be a waffle iron? What is it about the waffle and the grid that makes it better?
Well, that takes me back to one of the things that we talked about a little bit where with the waffle spaghetti and meatballs. So when you get the waffle, the texture in there, those nooks and crannies, it's perfect for collecting sauce.
Oh.
And that comes up with the waffled falafel, too, because you can spread some hummus on there, and it just settles in those divots, and it's perfect.
Plus, waffle falafel is really
awesome.
Fun to say.
Yes, it is as fun to say as it is to eat, for sure.
Now, we've been talking about all this crazy stuff there that we have to try a little different, but what about if you just want to make waffles in your waffle iron? Do you have a favorite recipe for that?
I do. So there are 53 recipes in the book for things to make in your waffle iron that are not waffles, but I didn't feel like I could write this book without including a couple recipes for waffles. So if you go all the way to the back of the book, there are two of my favorite waffle recipes. And probably my favorite of the two is the yeast-risen overnight waffle.
All right. Well, Daniel, sounds great. You've made us all really hungry. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Daniel Shumsky is the creator of Waffleizer.com and the author of the book, Will It Waffle? 53 Unexpected Recipes to Make in a Waffle Iron.
And we've got those recipes for red velvet ice cream sandwich waffles and waffled eggs migas up on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It seems that everywhere we turn these days, we're being told that we need to return to the kitchen, that cooking fresh, made-from-scratch meals is the key to physical health, to family well-being. Sounds perfect, right?
Well, not so fast. According to a new study, preparing and cooking family meals places significant stresses on a lot of families and poses a simply impossible task for others. And despite more dads getting involved in the work of getting the meals on the table, a lot of the burden still falls on mothers. So with that in mind, have home-cooked family meals become an unrealistic expectation today? Are there other solutions we can look to in order to feed our families and hang on to our sanity?
We're joined now by Sarah Bowen and Seneca Elliott. They're associate professors of sociology at North Carolina State University. They're the co-authors of the new paper, The Joy of Cooking? Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Seneca, thanks to you as well.
Glad to be here.
So, Sarah, let's start with the big question here. Are home-cooked family meals an unrealistic expectation for today's families?
Well, first of all, contrary to the stereotype that poor people especially are eating a lot of fast food, a lot of the families that we interviewed, both the lower income and the middle class families, were cooking a lot. They were cooking between 4 and 5 nights a week on average, with some people cooking more. So they are cooking a lot, the poor families, largely because it's the cheapest thing to do, and the middle class families because they thought it was important. One of our critiques is that at the same time, the ideal of what counts as home cooking and what counts as good food and, in a sense, good mothering keeps ramping up, and it's harder and harder to meet that kind of standard.
Is part of it that we have this sort of Norman Rockwell version of the family dinner in our head, that it had to be this everything from scratch meal that mom whipped up and put on the table at exactly the same time every day? Do we need to let the idea of the family dinner evolve?
I think, we do. When you hear about how we need to get back in the kitchen and how that's the path to good health and good families, we do have this image in our head of what it would look like. And we spent a lot of time both observing families while they ate and then interviewing a lot more families. And what we found was that it didn't look like that for a lot of families. And they were doing it. They were cooking at home. But it wasn't this idealistic, joyful experience all the time.
And Seneca, in those studies, what were some of the most common complaints you heard from the moms, usually in the family, about preparing that family meal?
Well, the moms across the board faced a lot of issues just around the time to prepare these meals. And the kinds of constraints they experienced might have varied from working class and poor families to middle class families. But everyone was pinched for time for different reasons. So, for example, a lot of the families that we interviewed, both parents, if there were both parents in the house, were employed. They were often employed in jobs that had unpredictable work schedules. They might not know their hours, their days, their shifts ahead of time. They often worked non-standard hours. And so all of these things compounded the difficulties that they had around creating this ideal family meal. And the middle-class families typically also dual income. We had families who were trying to get a business up and running, professionals who were putting in a lot of face time and experiencing the phenomenon of overwork that so many Americans experience. And so they, too, were struggling. So they would try to do things on the weekends to expedite the family meal, like prepping vegetables, but still said they always felt like it wasn't quite right and it was never quite enough.
Right, and that's an interesting thing, Seneca. that came up in your study is that middle-class moms had that kind of difficult choice to make between spending quality time with their children, which you're supposed to do as a good parent, or cooking. It was one or the other.
Right. And so we talked about time use. Studies show that time spent cooking has decreased for Americans. But at the same time, time spent with children directly engaged in care and engaging with children has actually increased. And so that's part of that expectation for parents to really intensively be with their children, to shuttle them to various activities that perhaps in the past, and we might have thought they would get their physical education, they would get extracurriculars in a school setting. But increasingly these things are happening after school hours, and parents are doing a lot of the effort to get their kids to these programs.
And Sarah, you mentioned earlier that part of the question here is what counts as a home-cooked meal? We keep hearing messages, don't eat processed food, don't eat prepared food, don't eat takeout. It only counts if you, it's only healthy if you make it yourself, more from scratch, the better. Is that tension, is that adding to, I guess, guilt for the nights we make fish sticks for the kids?
I think especially for the middle-class moms, it was. And they talked about, you know, feeling bad because they forgot to soak the beans, so then they had to use canned beans, or they couldn't put beans into it, or that they weren't eating enough fresh produce, or with the middle-class moms, they talked about how they couldn't afford to get as much organic food as they felt that they should be feeding their kids. And then with the poor families, they had different kinds of constraints, and it was related in part to money. And we know a lot now about, there's a lot in the news about how healthy food and especially fresh produce and lean meats and things like that cost more. But then another issue was that quite a lot of the families didn't have reliable transportation, and so they would shop once a month. And if you're shopping once a month, you're not going to buy a lot of fresh produce because it's going to go bad before you could use it. So they had constraints also in terms of whether they could even come close to making these ideal meals.
Well, Seneca, let's talk about fathers here. Why aren't they more involved in the cooking of these, you know, idealistic home-cooked meals?
Well, so those time use studies on the time Americans spend cooking, they does show that women have decreased their time spent cooking, and men have increased theirs slightly. It hasn't made up for the gap, and women are still doing more of the cooking than our men, but we don't want to suggest, and we hope our piece doesn't suggest, that men aren't involved in cooking in many homes. We've actually heard from a lot of men who said, "Hey, wait a minute, I cook," and so we don't want to discredit that. But in these households, again, because of work pressures and we also have a lot of families who are not partnered, so single mothers, and so there were fewer options in terms of having an extra person to pitch in and do the work of cooking. And the middle class households, they did have partners who were more active in the cooking, and the, of course, it's not just cooking, it's also planning, it's provisioning, it's cleaning up afterwards. As one of our participants pointed out, we think it's just about putting the food on the table, but there's a lot that goes on around that. But the moms describe themselves as the household managers, and so they might be planning meals and organizing shopping lists and making sure that these things get done. So there's a lot of invisible work that goes into preparing a family meal.
All right, so we've already got a gender issue here. There's the health, there's the money, there's the time and the stress, and that's already enough to give you indigestion when you're eating that meal. But also there's the yet another factor. If you make this food, are the kids going to eat it, especially if you're trying to make things healthy? Sarah, is that a complaint you heard from the parents you talked to?
And we said in the article that we observed a lot of meals, too, with some of the families that we did more in-depth observations with. And we almost never observed a meal where there wasn't at least one complaint about the food. And I think anyone who has kids knows that it can be difficult. They don't always do exactly what you want them to do. And food is one of those things. And for the middle-class moms, were working really hard to try to cultivate their kids' palates and develop these healthy tastes. And for the lower income moms, the fact that the kids might not eat it was a big risk. So because, you know, they couldn't afford to waste food if the kids refused to eat it. And so that had an effect on their cooking choices because it meant that they often would elect to make tried and true recipes or things that had been passed down, even if they were, you know, more processed or something like that, because at least they knew that the kids would eat it then.
We are talking with sociologists Sarah Bowen and Seneca Elliott about their research on the burden and the expectations that home-cooked meals place on a lot of families. And we want to hear from you, too.
Do you feel pressured to cook fresh home-cooked meals from scratch every night for your family, or do you think this is an unrealistic expectation? Are there solutions out there that you think would help, that would help you get those healthy meals on the table and retain your sanity? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with sociologists Sarah Bowen and Seneca Elliott. They've co-authored a new study that looks at the family dinner and the burden it often places on parents, especially moms.
And we're hoping you'll join in on this one at 800-642-1234. Do you make the time to make and prepare those home-cooked meals for your family? And if so, do you value that time, look forward to it, or do you kind of dread it? And if you're a mother, do you wonder sometimes if most of the work falls on you? Do you feel that burden? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Andrew on the line in Madison. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. Yeah, I'm a stay-at-home dad with a 13-month-old, and my wife works all day long. And I do all of our cooking, fresh cooking, every day. And we're extremely low-income family because I have to stay at home. And we have found that it's actually a lot cheaper for me to do gardening and farmers markets and get all fresh produce and fresh meats and things than it is to go to the grocery store and get processed food, even like mac and cheese and stuff. It's easier and cheaper to make it yourself than to go to a grocery store and buy it.
But that's a trade-off you've chosen to make, Andrew. You don't work, so you have the time to do that cooking. If you worked, if you were working even half-time, do you think you'd have time to do the gardening, the farmer's market, the prep from scratch?
I would believe so, because before I was stay-at-home dad, we did kind of the same thing. We still continued to try to cook as many fresh home-cooked meals as possible, make our own soups, soup bases, all kinds of things like that. We didn't do as much gardening. Now that I have a little more time, it's easier to do the gardening. But I would think that I would have continued on the path even if we didn't have a child.
Gotcha. Andrew, thank you so much for the call. And Seneca, that reminds me, he's got a 13-month-old now. Eventually he'll have after-school soccer practices or dance recitals or whatever. Are those things in the moms, the families you observed, also part of the stress on getting that dinner on the table?
Yes, they're a big part of the equation, and these things are often happening in the evenings, so they can very quickly or easily eclipse or conflict with the family meal. So this is absolutely a consideration. It can mean that things are rushed, that it's hard to assemble everyone at the same time, and that further adds to these time pressures that those moms are and dads are experiencing.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the call, Andrew, and let's move on to Lauren in Eau Claire. Hey, Lauren.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. How does this all resonate with you?
Oh, gosh. Well, my husband and I both work. We're very busy. And what this definitely resonates with me, by the time we pick up the kids and get home, it's 5:30, 6 o'clock, and then it's like, oh, well, geez, now it's a late dinner. What we try to do when we do cook is we try to cook in bulk. So we try to, if we're making chili or something like that, we'll make enough chili so that we can have leftovers so that it's not an every night thing that we have to cook. But yeah, definitely it's definitely challenging, and we've got a 3-year-old and a 6-month-old. So it's
right.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
So that's what we try to do.
Good for you. You've got a strategy there. Sounds like you're able to implement it. And that's something I have grand aspirations to do just what you do, Lauren, to cook ahead of time,
yeah.
Do a big massive cooking and bagging and freezing, whatever, on Sunday, but I almost never get to it. It's impressive that Lauren does, but what do you think about that, Sarah? Do we need to resort to things like that? Is that a new technique, just cooking in bulk? Will that help ease the burden?
Yeah, I mean, I think moms and families use different strategies depending on their schedules and you know, their work schedules and their income and lots of things. And so different families talked about different strategies. But one of the points that we tried to make was that if this is important and we hear a lot about how people need to cook, we need to talk about, are there strategies that could support families that are not just in their own kitchens? Are there things that we can do as a society if we think this is important? And so, you know, for the poor families, things like food access and wages, because having to work two jobs to make anything close to a living wage obviously affects your ability. So there are strategies that individual families are taking that work for them, and all the families are, you know, doing their best to feed their kids the way they think it's important. But one of our questions is, if we think this is important, are there other strategies that aren't just within these individual families?
What would those be?
Support them? Well, we don't know the answer. And we, you know, our study was focused on talking to these families and seeing what their situation was, not on trying to develop at this point at least any concrete proposals. But I think it's great that people are talking about food, and that's something that people in the United States are talking about a lot, and I think that's good and very exciting. And I think that we need to broaden the conversation and start talking about what that means collectively and not just within individual families and individual kids.
So if every single family more or less is struggling with this issue, maybe there's a solution outside of the family level, you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Lauren. We'll go to Tammy now in Onalaska. Tammy, hi.
Hi. I'm a stay-at-home mom who works on a couple of different jobs. I homeschool, and I do the bookwork for my husband's business. So I'm not your traditional stay-at-home mom. I wear a lot of hats. I have three grown children and one that's still at home, so I have a little bit of experience regarding kids eating and stuff like that. And I think probably one of the things that I see that relates to this is that it's really important to do one or two things really well. Sometimes we have a tendency to overschedule. And sometimes it's hard to say no to our kids, to be the parent, so to speak. And we want our kids to be happy. We want them to be our friends and everything like that. But you know what? We're the parent. We're responsible. So incorporate them with your cooking. Remember that when they're hungry, they'll eat. Don't let them eat snacks all the time. Don't let them eat what they quote-unquote want in between meals. Make sure they're hungry at supper time. And really remember that it's much, much cheaper to eat unprocessed foods than it is processed foods.
Tammy, thanks a lot for the call. At one point she brought up there, get the kids involved in making the food. At first, that's probably a little more work for the parents, but later it could be a time saver and it gets some buy-in from the kids. Seneca, in the families you observed and talked to, did you see that as a strategy? Have the kids be a part of the cooking?
Yes. We did, and I think this is part of the popular conversation about food and families, is bring the kids on board, get them excited about the meals, get them involved in preparing it, getting the ingredients, and then putting it together. In one of the households we observed, we watched this delightful moment where the family all assembled. They managed to get together after their busy day. We had originally, I think, scheduled to spend time with them earlier in the afternoon, and it just kept creeping to later and later, but finally managed to get everyone together and to make cupcakes, just watching these kids with cracking eggs and getting this stuff all over them, and you know, it was really fun. And it was just a delightful moment. But at the same time, we also saw a lot of kids being fussy, looking for attention, especially younger children, but also with older children, when their parents are trying to get a meal on the table. And a lot of the households where we spent time and observing families, the kitchens are very small. There's very little space, and so it can be very difficult to even just accommodate another individual in the kitchen because it's quite tight, so very little counter space, and things are often stacked on top of each other just to kind of get it all in. And so it kind of goes back to there are some fabulous things that people are doing, you know, cooking in bulk, getting kids involved. But these are things that are happening in individual homes. And as Sarah said earlier, if we can kind of broaden this to really think about if we value this kind of food and putting our money where our mouth is and figuring out ways that we can make this more accessible for a broader number of people.
Well, let's see if we can get in one more caller here. Joe in Watertown. Hi.
Oh, hey, guys. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. Hey, I have a 2-year-old. I have another baby coming in December, and
congrats.
me and my wife, we actually run a bakery in Watertown, me and my wife, too, so we're together all day long cooking, and I think through that, we've kind of realized how close we've become and how, I don't know, how much we miss family and everything and having that connection around the dinner table, and like that's kind of the biggest memories we have was that dinner moment with our parents and just talking around the table and helping with dinner and stuff, and so anyways, I incorporate my boy every night into the dinner table. He helps me set it. He helps me make food. He helped me snap the asparagus last night. So, yeah, I think it's a new revolution. I think a lot more people are starting to realize, you know, that really getting people involved is how you really end up having a family that's close.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Joe. Appreciate your story there. And what do you think, Seneca? Is this something people are craving? I mean, if all things were equal, would people really want to spend the time with this and sit down every night to their family? Maybe they just don't want to feel rushed while they're doing it.
Yeah, and I think food is important in our lives. It doesn't just meet a biological need, but it's long been a part of our celebrations and ways that we're social with others. And so we think there's lots of value to family meals. But also, again, to kind of think bigger, to breaking bread with friends, with neighbors, with coworkers, to thinking about how we can share this work, to thinking about how we can change our work lives to better accommodate what we'd all like to do, which is to sit down at the end of the day and eat a good meal.
All right, Seneca, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Sarah, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
That's Sarah Bowen and Seneca Elliott. They are associate professors of sociology at North Carolina State University. They're the co-authors of the new paper, The Joy of Cooking, which looks at the burden that home-cooked family meals are placing on a lot of us. You can keep the conversation going over at the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.